The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, equipping and supporting New York's startup business community with Mac repairs and upgrades, on-site setup and support, free seminars and events, equipment rentals, sales, consultation, and more. Studio.techserve.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And our focus this hour is on sensitive international issues and the blunt talk from the presidential campaign. Are they compatible? Can U.S.-China relations make progress in an environment where accusations fly and threatened confrontations are the election soundbite of the day? Can nuclear global policy seriously address threats in the world in the midst of rhetoric calling for nukes to be handed out to countries that don't now have them? Here's Republican frontrunner Donald Trump at a CNN town hall talking about his approach to nukes in Japan and South Korea.
At some point, we have to say, you know what? We're better off if Japan protects itself against this maniac in North Korea. We're better off, frankly, if South Korea is going to start to protect itself.
Saudi Arabia,
we
nuclear
have to,
weapons?
Saudi Arabia, absolutely.
You would be fine with them having nuclear weapons?
No, not nuclear weapons, okay. But they have to protect themselves or they have to pay us. Here's the thing. With Japan, they have to pay us or we have to let them protect themselves.
But if you say to Japan, yes, it's fine, you get nuclear weapons, South Korea, you as well, and Saudi Arabia says we want them too.
Can I be honest with you? It's going to happen anyway. It's going to happen anyway. It's only a question of time.
It's going to happen anyway. It's only a matter of time. Well, calling for nuclear weapons to be brought to zero on all sides has been the stated goal of the post-war international community. But is Donald Trump calling a bluff here? Japan is planning new factories to obtain plutonium that will add to the world's stockpiles of bomb fuel, and in South Korea there is support for a nuclear weapons program to deter Kim Jong-un in the north.
South Korea possesses enough nuclear material to make 4,000 nuclear weapons, he says. All we need is our president's approval. If we have nuclear weapons, we'll be in a much better position to deal with North Korea.
That's Chung Song Chang, a security analyst at the Sejong Institute in South Korea. Today, President Obama and 50 world leaders meet in Washington, D.C. at the Nuclear Security Summit to find agreement on keeping nuclear missiles and nuclear materials out of the hands of terrorists and to deter states from obtaining the bomb. Deborah Decker, senior advisor at the Stimson Center, goes back to the Cold War days and arms control talks of the 1970s and 80s. She will be presenting at the Nuclear Security Summit later today and says that projecting a nuclear defense by offering our allies use of our nuclear arsenal for a fee, as Donald Trump has suggested, might be a transformative approach. But right now, she's not hearing it in the current rhetoric.
I think Donald Trump has a point in there that people aren't picking up on, that they need to protect themselves and they need to pay for what they are getting. And the United States has been had its nuclear umbrella over a lot of countries, and I think that's appropriate. However, the cost of that is something that could be discussed.
Do you think Donald Trump is viewing this nuclear umbrella question in the same way he views his own conceal and carry permit that he has to own a firearm?
I think probably he does. And I think it's quite different to be carrying a firearm than to be carrying a nuclear weapon in your pocket. Firearm gets taken away, bad things can happen, as we've seen. If someone steals a nuclear weapon or nuclear usable material and uses it in a bad way, which of course they would do, it becomes apocalyptic.
If there is a nuclear arms race between North Korea and South Korea, and mutual assured destruction is the means by which we're assured that neither one of those countries is going to use a nuclear weapon. Does that make you sleep well at night?
Not at all, because the key question is, can they protect those weapons? Can they keep track of those weapons? Even in the United States, we've had issues of not keeping track of some of our weapons and having two bombs fly over the United States, nuclear bombs, without the Air Force quite being aware of it a number of years ago. We've had issues of some of our bases having some drug problems. So these are issues that are being addressed in this country where we think we are responsible. Think about that in another country where maybe you wouldn't have that level of accountability, or maybe you'd even be willing, as North Korea might be, to sell some weapons to make money in order to support your country. So there's not that level of accountability and responsibility that we had when we only had two people facing off, or two countries facing off against each other. Now we would have the potential for diversion in that material, and there's nobody to strike back at. So who did it? New York blows up. Who did it? Well, I mean, if you could trace it back to somewhere, that would be great. But in the short term, you may not be able to. It could be some faceless ISIS person somewhere that had obtained a small TAC nuke from North Korea. Do we want that?
Well, I certainly don't want that. Mutual assured destruction seems to have worked in India and Pakistan. These are two countries that have gone to war a number of occasions. They're both nuclear. Yet somehow there seems to be a deterrence balance there that keeps them from going all out at each other. Do you think mutual assured destruction is working in South Asia, or have we just been lucky?
I think we've been very lucky there, and it's an issue that one has to continue to worry about. There have been continued skirmishes. In my opinion, just keep your fingers crossed on that one.
Well, keeping your fingers crossed was not a doctrine that you were familiar with during the arms control talks of the Cold War period that you were, you know, instrumental in. How are
let me interrupt you on that, yeah, because I had nightmares for 10 years after that. If you could see how dangerous that period was, you wouldn't be talking about, or Donald Trump wouldn't be talking about, what he's talking about now. And we still today, unfortunately, have our nuclear weapons on pretty much hair trigger alert. I don't think that's the way we want the future to go. And I really appreciate the fact that we're trying to go to a nuclear zero, where we're trying to theoretically reduce our reliance on nuclear weapons. And I hope in the future, that's the way we go, and that would be a real challenge for the next president.
Deborah Decker is senior advisor at the Stimson Center and the co-author of two recent reports, Nuclear Energy Securing the Future, A Case for Voluntary Consensus Standards and the Quest for Nuclear Security Standards. Deborah, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me, John.
On the sidelines, you might say, of the nuclear summit today is a one-on-one meeting between President Obama and Chinese President Xi Jinping. It's another attempt to de-accelerate growing tension over China's ambitious military expansion in the South China Sea. The U.S. claims the area is open to all maritime traffic, especially that of its regional allies like the Philippines and Vietnam, as American warships continue to defiantly patrol the contested territory. But none of it seems to be slowing China down. With me to talk about whether or not the two leaders can reach an agreement is Bonnie Glaser, who's senior advisor for Asia at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Bonnie, hello.
Hi, John.
Do you think that the Chinese are, significantly and sincerely engaged with the Obama administration right now, or are they playing a waiting game like the Senate is about the Supreme Court nominations?
The Chinese are definitely looking beyond the Obama administration. That doesn't mean that they don't want to have a good summit with President Obama. They want to keep this relationship stable. They would like to continue to advance their interests during the remaining 9 months. But they are paying close attention, just as every other country in the world is, to the presidential race in the United States and trying to figure out what's coming next.
We've seen in the South China Sea that China is developing little islands, drilling platforms, et cetera, to create sort of facts on the ground or facts in the water. We've also seen that Vietnam, Malaysia, and the Philippines have done the same sort of thing. Is this a doctrine going forward that you are disturbed by, or will it eventually resolve itself?
Well, first, I think we really have to make a distinction between what China is doing and other countries have done. Countries like Vietnam, Malaysia, the Philippines, even Taiwan have engaged in very small-scale dredging, expanding existing islands that they have. What the Chinese have done has been massive. They've created 7 islands in the Spratly chain, 3 of which now have 10,000-foot airfields on them. And they are, again, installing radars and other equipment that really appears to have military purposes. and the ability to project power from them, whereas these other smaller countries that have military capabilities, they're very limited to defensive purposes.
The Philippines is a principal in this South China Sea conflict. Is the U.S. on board of Philippine policy, or are they trying to mediate?
The United States has a mutual defense treaty with the Philippines. It is certainly not mediating between the U.S. and China, but the U.S. Would be obligated to come to the Philippines' defense if the Chinese were to use force against a Philippines naval ship, for example, or fired on a Filipino soldier. So the U.S. is calling for all countries, not just the Philippines and China, but the other claimants to exercise some self-restraint and to rely on diplomacy to solve these disputes without using force. But the Obama administration has not really made much headway in this regard, just calling for everybody to sit back and tell the Chinese to stop land reclamation and not further militarize the situation. This hasn't had much traction.
We're talking with Bonnie Glaser, who's Senior Advisor for Asia at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Just one second before we go, this whole doctrine has changed the language of U.S.-China relations. What's the nine-dash line before we go?
The nine-dash line is a claim that originates with the 11-dash line that the Republic of China drew in 1947. The Chinese had resolved two dashes with Vietnam and along their border and in the Gulf of Tonkin. And so now it's a nine-dash line. The Chinese first gave this to, they submitted it to the United Nations in May of 2009 and suggested that it is a claim within which they claim something, but they don't say, is it all the waters? Is it just the land features? So they're deliberately ambiguous about what inside this nine dashes they actually claim. And that is exactly what the Philippines is trying to challenge China on in a case that it has brought against China in The Hague. This is an arbitral tribunal under the Convention on the Law of the Sea. And in May or June, we are likely to hear a decision from that tribunal. And it is quite possible that it will find that this nine-dash line is not consistent with current international law.
Drawing on maps, making international precedents, Bonnie Glaser is Senior Advisor for Asia at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and at the center of a security cordon down in Washington, D.C. Bonnie, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. On Wednesday, the Food and Drug Administration issued significant new guidelines for a drug called Mifeprex, a medication that induces abortion within 70 days of a woman's last menstrual period. The guidelines suggest a dose only a third of what was studied in clinical trials, and the lower cost from this dose and fewer side effects could mean that many more women may gain access to medication-induced abortion. Dr. Leah Torres is an OBGYN practicing in Utah, specializing in reproductive health. She says medication-induced abortions are attractive to people for a variety of reasons.
I've seen patients say they would rather have a miscarriage-type experience over a procedure, so that's why they choose the medication abortion. Others want to just have the privacy of their own home. I don't think it has much to do with the political climate. However, the anti-abortion laws that are in place in many states, including my own, can make this very safe procedure and medical treatment unavailable to a lot of people.
Why such a significant change based on the clinical trials that were in the late 90s and have continued since then?
Well, we're always striving to do what's best for our patients, improving safety, reducing side effects, lowering risks. That's really a goal of medical research. And so over the years, we always are asking ourselves, can we do this better? And with Mifepristone or Mifeprex, we were able to do it better. We were able to develop regimens that were effective and safe and with fewer side effects and lower costs. And so regardless of what we were doing, you know, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, 100 years ago, we modify our practices according to the evidence that we gather over the years through clinical trials. And that's what's happened with mifepristone, Mifeprex. That's what's happened with several other drugs, surgeries, procedures, any aspect of medical care. This is very typical.
What would you say is the most important implication of this for women everywhere in the United States who might find this information relevant to them?
I think what's important is that the FDA is saying, we believe in clinical research and we want people to be safe. We, as physicians, have been using this medication this way for over a decade at least. I'm still young in my practice. And so when anti-abortion activists force physicians to practice outdated medicine, it only increases risks to patients. So I think, you know, our community, our patients need to realize the FDA is actually behind them and trying to protect their safety and improve their medical care.
Safety is the presumed motivation of certain state laws that try to force doctors to be affiliated with a hospital in cases of abortion. Is there a court case that is sort of on the horizon which may affect access to this drug on safety or any other grounds?
I believe so. I don't know all of the intricacies of HB2 that is going to the Supreme Court that is in process. I do believe that is one aspect. There's no one more interested in patient safety than the person caring for them. That is their healthcare provider. That is me. When laws prohibit me from providing the best medical care to my patients, their lives are at risk. And that is not hyperbole. That is actually true. The admitting privileges law in many states, including my own, has no medical basis. And fortunately, I've not had an experience where I've been restricted, but there are physicians who have, and for no reason except that they provide abortions, which only harms those who are seeking safe abortion care.
Leah Torres is an OBGYN practicing in Utah, specializing in reproductive health. Doctor, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, John.
Loose talk about nukes by presidential candidates gets attention, just as when the subject is reproductive rights. Presidential frontrunner Donald Trump had his say on what the consequences should be for women having abortions on Wednesday, and he seemed not to clearly understand the status quo.
Do you believe in punishment for abortion, yes or no, as a principle?
There has to be some form of punishment.
It's Donald Trump at an MSNBC town hall last night. He later clarified his comments in a statement saying, the doctor or any other person performing this illegal act upon a woman would be held legally responsible, not the woman. The woman is a victim in this case, as is the life in her womb. My position has not changed. Like Ronald Reagan, I am pro-life with exceptions. There. All cleared up, right? Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. We're settled. Do we even need to talk anymore?
There's the amount of debate that this has sparked within the conservative part of the Republican Party. Not debate. I shouldn't say debate. Just absolute rage at Donald Trump for the way this went down. And the glee among pro-choice conservatives, progressives, Democratic candidates at what Donald Trump seems to have done here. John, the other part of Donald Trump's comments, which were in Queens, there in New York at this MSNBC town hall, he was asked specifically by Chris Matthews if there should be some form of punishment for the woman. He responded yes to that. It was a couple of hours later with the stunning reversal that you read where he says, my position hasn't changed. Of course, it had changed. It had changed very, very drastically. Let's go to the other candidates first. Ted Cruz, who speaks about abortion frequently on the campaign trail, said that it was clear that Donald Trump simply didn't have any grasp of conservative policies and that he says anything to get attention. John Kasich sounded off as well. He was asked about it. Listen.
I do have exceptions for rape, incest, and life of the mother, but of course women shouldn't be punished. I don't look, I think probably Donald Trump will figure out a way to say that he didn't say it or he was misquoted or whatever.
And he already has, apparently. But I mean, the Donald Trump has been a liberal on this question. During his pre-political career, that is a fact.
For many, many years, pro-choice, he says that he reversed on that. There isn't much of a record of Donald Trump publicly reversing on that issue before 2011 when he started to actually make noises in public about potentially running for president. And John, you're right to bring it up because this is one of the key factors about Donald Trump that causes so much anger and distrust among conservatives. There are many, by the way, this isn't the only one, but all of the abortion groups yesterday almost in unison came out with statements. March for Life calling Donald Trump out of touch on abortion. They say they have never advocated for women being punished. National Right to Life called him inept. And the National Review magazine, that bastion of conservatism, John, went as far as to say Donald Trump needs to be blackballed. They said he has done irreparable damage to the cause of conservatism that they've spent 60 years trying to build up. So this was not your normal sort of eye-rolling response to yet another slippery or changing Donald Trump position. Now, on the Democratic side, and this is part of what's gotten conservatives so upset, is the amount of ammunition it seems to have given to the Democrats. The National Review also saying that Donald Trump has given progressives the exact caricature on abortion that they've always used against conservatives, that they want to punish women for having abortions. Bernie Sanders went on television and said, "I don't know what world Donald Trump is living in." The response from Hillary Clinton, John, largely on Twitter, 9 tweets within an hour, wow, calling Donald Trump horrific, saying his position was telling, saying women can't let anyone with positions like this anywhere near the White House. A campaign video on the internet cut within 2 hours. A massive response from the Clinton campaign.
Now, you know, whatever we may think about abortion, whatever the debate is on abortion, perhaps the most damaging thing for the GOP here is that the whole campaign, from their perspective, is going to be about abortion, and that seems like a throwback to the 1980s.
And it also exposes the rift that is absolutely tearing this party asunder right now. Donald Trump supporters, which top out at about 35% of the party, versus conservatives. It's going to play out in Wisconsin next week on Tuesday. That's my prediction. It's going to hurt Donald Trump badly as suburban people come out and maybe deal him a loss there. Not because of this, but in addition to it, John.
Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks so much, Todd.
You got it.
This week on The Takeaway, we're sharing an unexpected story of reconciliation from the life of Alvin Hall. It was an emotional trip back to high school for our colleague, with us tagging along. Alvin's success in high school had been overlooked or just plain erased by folks at his high school, even though he had gone on to become a financial advisor to some very wealthy individuals and institutions. You'd be surprised what you can learn about finance, being raised in a dirt-poor part of Florida by your grandmother. Back for the first time in 40 years and with his high school making final preparations for Alvin Hall Day, there was time for Alvin to fill in a few historical blanks. And it started with some good food at the Wakulla Springs Lodge.
When I was growing up, you couldn't come here as a black person. Or if you could, it was only on limited days because we never came.
I have
to try this. This is really good. Mullet and potato salad.
Yeah.
And black apple juice.
Yeah.
My grandmother and his father are sisters and brothers. So he is my first cousin once removed. I think he was 16 years old when he left Wakulla County, and he had not been back for many, many years. So he kind of disconnected from, you know, the people, places, and things of this area.
That's my cousin Tanya on my father's side, and she's absolutely right. This is my hometown, and for the best part of 40 years, I have had nothing to do with it whatsoever. I would come home for the occasional funeral, see a few relatives I cared about, and fly back to my life in New York City. I didn't write and seldom called. And the reasons, I guess, are many. People move, people want to move. I know I did. I knew I needed to get out of Wakulla. I knew from my reading that there was a bigger world out there, and I wanted to find out more about it and to experience it. I wanted to have my own life, create my history. My life was in front of me, not at the high school I attended in the 1970s. What was to be gained by going back? Absolutely nothing. Everything I needed from my childhood was inside me, and I had sorted through it all and made my choices. I had nothing to gain by going back. Turns out, I was wrong.
It starts at 21. There he is, right?
Wow.
That's him. Let's go back.
By now, you may have worked out that my father played no part in my upbringing. The only thing I can recall are vague memories. So I had no idea what was about to happen next when Cousin Tanya and I sat down and made ourselves comfortable. And if you'd like to draw the curtains, we'll play the tape.
These are home videos from the 60s.
From the 60s?
Yes, this is from the 60s.
There is no footage of me with my father. There's no photograph.
Never even saw him.
I only recall his coming by the house one time in my whole life, and I have no memory other than a car coming up and this man getting out of the car who was my father. Mm. And I have no memory of what he looks like or anything.
Mm-hmm. There he is, right?
Wow.
That's him.
So now I see where my face comes from.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing. For me, this potentially solves a problem of all these aspects of my personality, which are distinctly different from that of my other brothers and sisters. Why I like to travel, why I move around the way I do, why I'm so sociable, why I take risks. Thank you. Thank you so much for this.
You're welcome.
You've always been the kindest to me. Always.
I have.
Yes, for my father's side of the family, you have always been the kindest.
Isn't that a blessing?
Yes, it is. And things were about to get even more emotional. On the eve of what my old school had decided to call Alvin Hall Day, there was time for me and my producer, Dana, to check in with my 83-year-old Aunt Effie. She is one of my oldest living family members on my father's side.
I love him. Yes, I love him. He's my nephew.
What do you think about tomorrow, Alvin Hall Day? In what color?
Alvin Hall Day. Beautiful. Beautiful. Oh, I love it. That's great. He deserves it. He deserves it. You know, being born and raised in Wakala. I am very proud of him. Very, very proud of him. Yeah.
One of the grand youthful fantasies when I was growing up was escaping the city and the suburbs with a car full of musical instruments and finding some beautiful deserted spot away from everything to just play. I was never any good, but that didn't stop the fantasy. That fantasy, though, has been a reality for a lot of musicians. The studio in the woods, getting inspired by the songs of the earth, communing with some primal rhythms and all the ghosts who've come before. This song, performed by a band named Oregon that literally did play out in the vistas and natural splendor of the Pacific Northwest, was actually a modest hit back in 1969. But it is the melodic rendering of a Native American chant, an ancient peyote ceremony, Witchy Tai To, written by jazz player Jim Pepper of the Kaw and Creek Nations.
Witchy Tai To, gimme wa, hora nika hora ne, ya na ne no. Witchy Tai To, gimme wa.
However solitary the American countryside, there has always been a voice that came before. Channeling such a ghost is the mission in part of the latest album by Marco Benevento. You know him. He's played with everyone from members of Fish and Tortoise, Brad Mehldau. Tracks from the Benevento Russo duo have appeared on this program for years.
It's how I live. It's how I feel it.
Marco has a treasured music studio on the upstate New York property in Saugerties he escaped 2 years ago. But it has a ghost. Benevento's new solo album, out tomorrow, is called The Story of Fred Short, named for the Native American man who once lived on his land. With some stories of his music and his ghosts, Here is Marco Benevento in his own words.
How you doing? This is Marco Benevento. Happy to be here on The Takeaway. You know, there's a great documentary called Here Is What Is about Daniel Lanois, and Brian Eno is in it. And there's this sort of off-camera moment. And Eno said to Daniel Lanois, you know, you have to let people know in your documentary that music comes from nothing. It comes from a little tiny seed that needs nurturing and needs time to develop into a song or a verse. The piano is like, it's my axe, you know, it's my instrument. It's what I feel the most comfortable sitting in front of as far as instruments go. And I feel like I can get around on it. So I can really mess around with ideas, you know, changing chords. However, you know, sometimes I'll sit with a drum machine sound loop going, and then I'll play bass, and then maybe sing over that, and then maybe add piano after the fact. For the most part, I'm doing the production, the engineering, you know, the drum machines, the synths, the vocals and the piano and the songwriting. And then Andy Borger, our drummer, and Dave Drywitz, our bass player, they would come up and I'd have Andy sort of re-record my drum part that my mock drum part that I made, and have Dave sort of re-record the bass. All the Other Dreams. That's... song started with this Casio RC1 drum machine that I have. All the other dreams, turning up the volume, from a wiggle to a scream, I begin to go numb. That particular song, All the Other Dreams, is maybe the most synthy and dance poppy on the record, I feel like. And I basically just came up with this progression, you know. And then the bass line came up like... And that bass line really came out... And then the drum part sort of came in, and then that melody just sort of came screaming at me. I didn't try too hard to find that one. That was kind of just popped right in there. Well, I live on Fred Short Road in Saugerties, and... anytime I would tell my friends to come over, you know, I'd give them my address, and then they would always ask, oh, who's Fred Short? You know, what is this funny name? And I've just been asking people about, you know, who Fred Short is, because if you search online, you don't get anything. I collect pianos and go on Craigslist and find free pianos, and I went to go pick up a piano. And this old guy was like, oh, where do you live? Where are you going with this? You know, and I said, oh, I live on Fred Short Road. And he said that this piano actually was in that family, Fred Short's family. So I took that piano home and just was thinking about this, you know, Native American Vision Quest guy that traveled from New Mexico to the Catskills, and this deep-rooted family that's come such a long way. And I got this piano, and I started improvising on this piano, and I did an improvisation in my studio for about an hour and a half. And I had the synths going, the drum machines going, and this piano, thinking about Fred Short and what this guy was. And I improvised what's now on side B. I did that in an improvisation, and then basically over the last year, I've extracted all the different song ideas and made them more into clear song ideas, and then... kept the songs in order, kept the segues, tried to keep the improvisation feel, you know, where like things just speed up a little and goes in the next part and then speeds up again and goes in the third part, and then the band comes down and there's a wash of synths that bring us into this next sort of epic rock part, and then it morphs into this another drum machine part that eventually leads you to the end of this story of Fred Short. It was just a creative evening in my studio that eventually took shape over the course of like a year, and us playing it live and me describing to our drummer, hey, I have an idea, these three songs kind of go into each other, it speeds up here, speeds up there, and everybody eventually getting it. It takes time and finesse. So the improvising part of it is just trying to get into the right mind frame and trying to be in this, trying to be in a sort of calm, quiet sort of place in your head. And, coming up with little song ideas, hearing these little parts and thinking, oh, that little progression, those two chords and that little melody line, that's a great idea for a song. It takes a lot of time to finally turn a song into a song, I feel.
I wanna see you in the afternoon tomorrow. Don't have to walk the blocks in sorrow.
The Resurrection of Fred Short, Native American. Marco Benevento's new album, The Story of Fred Short, is available on his website and on iTunes starting tomorrow. The perfect spring thought. But want some more of Marco Benevento to take with you? You can check out the live performance of In the Afternoon tomorrow, recorded in our studio. You're hearing some of it now, all at our website, thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. Thank you, Fred Short. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Having breakfast on Park and Vine this evening. Gonna ride the train to Copenhagen. Don't have to walk the blocks in sorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.